I'm very pleased to welcome to the studio today two representatives of an organisation that's really quite well known locally, the Renegrove Hospice Care. We're going to come back to Renegrove in a few moments, but first of all I want to welcome Sue Varvel, who is the Director of Nursing and Clinical Services, and Les Pedrick, who is one of many, many, many volunteers at Grove House. He's going to tell us more about what he specifically does. So the hospice movement actually is fairly recent, but the origins go back a long way in time, don't they? I mean, what does the word hospice mean?
The hospice movement and the approach really goes back to biblical times. There are references to it in the Bible, to a place of rest for travellers. But we came into the modern movement, I suppose, in the 50s. Dame Cicely Saunders got interested in the fact that patients really weren't being cared for holistically. And so she started a movement and applied the principles of hospice approach to the care given to patients initially in a hospice building and set up St Christopher's Hospice in 1967.
Holistic, by that you mean?
It's not treating the illness and it's not treating the symptoms. It's treating the person as a whole. Because the reality is when you have any illness, you have any anxieties that go around with that, concerns, misunderstandings. So it's about sort of supporting people through that whole process. But clearly, initially, it was for people who were in the terminal stages of their lives. So the hospice movement at that stage was really linked to people who were certainly in palliative care, which is a non-curative care, but also really probably within the last year of their life. And that's continued to be the case. The government talks about end-of-life care, and for a number of years it's been considered to be the approach we take within the last year of life for someone deemed to have a prognosis for that length of time.
Could you deal with somebody who has a longer prognosis than that?
The trouble is nowadays you don't quite know. We talk about something called the surprise question in health at the moment, and GPs or us, when we're trying to assess patients, we're asked to say on some forms, oh, we would be surprised if somebody dies within the next year. Well, it's very, very difficult to say nowadays, because none of the illnesses that patients have that we care for, that's cancers and non-cancers, are predictable. Cancers are being treated very proactively and effectively nowadays. Early diagnosis is really good now. The testing, and actually the routine testing that GPs and the national programmes do, picks up all sorts of early signs, and therefore treatment is much more effective. There's research all the time, so people are having much more effective programmes of treatment. And when they are treated, very often, they go into remission. And although we might help people through a period of time when they are really unwell, they may have their treatment and be more unwell with treatment, but then they recover and then we discharge them, because that disease trajectory now is no longer a certainty. So people live with uncertainty of diagnosis, uncertainty of prognosis, and then, you know, hopefully we can help them to live a long and productive life after their illness.
It's about understanding how to live a life, is that right?
It's actually ensuring you reach your potential. I believe that sometimes patients will get a diagnosis and think, oh crikey, I've got to die now. So I think they learn to die, and we support them through that. And over the years, I think that's been the principal care of hospices, that we make sure people are comfortable, they don't feel anxiety, they have their family around them, but actually they may not die. So they don't want to be lying there waiting. We want them to be out there having a holiday and enjoying themselves and going to parties. And, you know, there's no reason why nowadays, with the treatment being quite as good as it is, that a great number of patients can't continue to live well with their illnesses. It's slightly less predictable for people with non-cancer diagnoses. So people with some elements of heart failure or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, they're very up and down anyway throughout people's lives. They learn to live with that, and they still learn to maximize their living. So in a way, we're trying to apply that principle to both conditions, really.
And so although the assumption may be from people like me that you're dealing mostly with people who have cancer, in fact that is probably a large part of your patient base, but you do help people who have other chronic or life-threatening
conditions. We do. Probably about 85%, 80 to 85% of our patients have a cancer diagnosis, and the rest have non-cancer diagnoses. Because of the length of time we tend to care for patients, those with non-cancer would come perhaps later, when people are very sure that they would be in the latter stages. But I'd say the majority of our care in our adult team is with cancer diagnosis.
Let's talk now about Renegrove, because as I said at the beginning, it's a fairly well-known locally, because it's got good PR, it's good marketing, it makes itself visible, and you have to, because you need to raise a lot of money. Is it part of the NHS? Is it independent? How does this work?
We're a charity. We're a voluntary sector organisation, but we are funded to about 18% by the NHS. The remainder is raised by us and the very generous public out there in a number of ways. So at the moment, we have 28 shops across our patch, and we have a very active and efficient and effective fundraising team. We're setting our budget for next year of almost £8 million. So it's a huge amount. But we don't just cover North West Hearts. We have two teams in North West Hearts, but we cover quite a significant area of Buckinghamshire as well. So it's quite a large organisation, really.
And the size of that has come from the merger between two separate organisations. There was the Ian Rennie organisation, yeah. there was Grove House.
Yes.
And probably a lot of people in this area will know Grove House.
Yes.
It's physically within the grounds, as it were, of the hospital. Mm. But you cover two counties.
We do. Both organisations, when we worked separately, worked on supporting patients at home. Grove House by enabling people to come in for the day to day hospice and come to clinics to have sessions of occupational therapy and physiotherapy and be visited at home by those therapists. And Ian Rennie, who were based at that time in Decorum, had a hospice at home service that just visited at home. Now, we shared patients all the way through, right from the time we were both set up. So it was a very natural fit when the discussions were had about sharing a senior role to try and manage the organisations and share some costs and develop the services. And the chief exec at the time, Mark Lister, wanted us to set up hospice at home in St Albans to equalise the services that were available to patients. So it was a wonderful opportunity, actually. Mergers are always slightly difficult, and we know that we've got wonderful supporters in both organisations that found it slightly threatening at the time, but the success of it now is amazing. We're seeing more and more patients every year. Last year, almost 1,700 patients across our patch. 10% increase every year on the numbers of patients we see. It's huge.
So the increase also, therefore, in the need for volunteers,
yeah,
and for funds. Absolutely. As you are a volunteer with a keen eye on aspects of funding, I think that's right, isn't it? First of all, what do you volunteer as?
If you like, my day job is in the Grove House Day Hospice, and I give a day a week to that. Working with a really good team of volunteers, most of whom have been volunteering for Rennie Grove much longer than I have.
Tell me what that means when you say you remember the day. Somebody, supposing I'm a patient, I come in, I am met by you or a medical person?
You're brought in by our wonderful volunteer drivers to start with, and they actually will deliver you, bring you through the door, and will give patients who've all got life-limiting conditions a day of activity, and that's kind of recreational, lunch, tea, coffees, that kind of thing, and hopefully send them on their way at the end of the day feeling perhaps a little bit brighter than they were when they started.
Why would I come into Grove House? I mean, if I don't want to mix with other people, I feel pretty rough, and you're going to make me sit down and play games or something. What do you do?
We always say to the patients, it's your day, you take from it what you like. If you want to join in the activity we've got, that's absolutely fine, and you know, we'll include you. If you want to sit apart, if you want a quiet day, if you're not feeling so great, and those things do happen, that's fine, we'll leave you alone and you can just have a day at ease, but knowing there's actually people around to engage with if you want to.
And if I'm in that situation, will I encounter a nurse or somebody who's medically trained so I can get some advice or more information?
All of the patients during the course of the day will have a one-to-one with a nurse where they can bring up any issues that are bothering them, can bring them up to date on their condition, can get advice. So yes, that clinical support is there, as well as the emotional support that I like to think that we volunteers give.
And how many volunteers would you have in one day?
In the day hospice, yes. The teams generally are around about six. Sometimes the number of patients fluctuate. I mean, we can have as many as 18, we can have as few as eight, but generally speaking, there are six of us. And obviously, the more volunteers you have per patient, the more personal attention, if you like, you can give them.
You're not only a volunteer specifically in this case, but also you are interested in promoting an understanding of Rennie Grove and fundraising?
When I retired 3 years ago or so, I went to work with a national charity for a short spell. Enjoyed it, but it wasn't quite what I was looking for. And then I lost two friends to cancer in fairly short order. And that's really what steered me towards Rennie Grove. And I got involved pretty much in the way of the day hospice, but then had it, if you like, a growing appreciation of all the good work that Rennie Grove do, and actually really wanted to put that out there to the public, knowing, as Sue said, how much we do rely on the public support. So that's very much what I see part of my role is doing now, albeit perhaps slightly more spasmodically than my day hospice role.
But is there a sort of a marketing team? I mean, you have a half a page in every week's Hearts Advertiser, and that refers to lots of activities that are going on, the fun runs and whatever else. And is there a marketing team within Rennie Grove that's driving that? Is it a lot of it volunteering anyway?
There isn't formally. We do have a communications and marketing team. It's not huge. We try to put our funds into the clinical services, but of course, communications with our public and using people like Lester to get the message across is a really good way. We have some other people we train and call ambassadors, go and do talks on our behalf to companies and groups and interested people, really, with an aim to spread the word about the service for the patients, but also to encourage people to give if they can.
We've seen what Les does as a volunteer. Do you have lots of different types of volunteering?
Well, we have 1,500 volunteers, at least, at the moment. We had a look recently because we're very lucky. We submitted an application for Queen's Award for volunteering last year and were successful and were awarded that this year. And we looked at the number of types of roles and there were at least 74. And when we walk around our offices, you can't really tell whether they are volunteers or employed people, because people are employed in all sorts of roles as volunteers. So in our finance department, fundraising department, we have clinical volunteers who support our nurses in every area. HR.
So would that mean that a retired nurse or even a GP or whatever could come and volunteer?
Yes, we would encourage anybody. I think everybody that volunteers on any level, in any role actually, get something in return, because it's a benefit. Everybody that we have has such special skills. They have their own individual personality. They have their own experience to bring to us. And it really adds to the service that we can give. And the background services, all the backroom services, finance, fundraising, HR, that we couldn't manage those services without people like Les.
We're talking about volunteers, Les, of all sorts, and you mentioned drivers. Every winter, we may or may not have heavy snow. We've had some this year. We didn't have any last year, as far as I can remember. What happens when it snows? What do you need for that?
We're very fortunate in actually having a team of drivers, many of whom have all-weather cars, 4x4s and the like, and they've got tremendous commitment. I mean, as we like to think all our volunteers have, but they actually go out in all weathers, and somehow they either get the patients in or they get the nurses out, and so the service continues in all weathers.
We did manage incredibly well recently with the snow. Even at night, we had the most amazing 4x4 drivers, or skilled drivers who had cars with chains, who were willing to take our nurses and visit patients. So we didn't stop our service at all. But anybody who's got a 4x4 experience and very happy to support us occasionally if they feel able, that's an ask.
How much time would a volunteer have to commit as a minimum?
I don't know, there is an absolute minimum. I do a day at day hospice and then I do ad hoc things on the advocacy and fundraising fronts. But people go in and do half a day in a shop. They do half a day in the tea bar at the magistrate's court. Pretty much whatever time you can spare, I think we would find a use for. And people shouldn't hold back because they think they can't give enough.
Now, you're medically trained yourself. You started out as a nurse.
Yes.
And you're now Director of Nursing and Clinical Services. Yes. Here you've got a team of professionally trained nurses. Do you have consultants coming in? What's the range?
We employ a doctor very part-time, one day, who comes into day hospice, actually, and does some medical assessments for the patients. We have about 90 nurses across all of our hospice at home teams. We've got 5 hospice at home teams based in some of the old PCT areas. So when I say in this area, Decorum and St Albans and Harpenden, we have one team in each of those. Each team serves probably a population of maybe 150,000 people, and that's the same in Buckinghamshire. So we have 5 teams of nurses. We have other supporters in those teams, healthcare assistants, who are trained care assistants who will go and do support visits and be the eyes and ears for the nurses. And we have healthcare assistants as well in day hospice. We have 2 oxygen occupational therapist, a physiotherapist, and we have family support services team. Some have background in nursing, some are counsellors, so a range of practitioners. But we don't actually own our own consultant, so we access professional and specialist support from other agencies because they're not our patients. They're an NHS patient that needs support. We share the care with the GP, actually, so they remain the prescribing doctor and the lead in their care. So it's very much a shared activity.
So will every GP automatically say to their patients, I think you would benefit from being in touch with your local hospice?
That's where we tend to get our referrals from. GPs, district nurses, hospital consultants, outpatient clinics, hospital wards when they're discharging patients. But the GP is the key person. Day hospice is a great resource because it does have a very great clinical aspect to it. All patients are assessed. The great benefit to me is something Les was talking to me about earlier, is about the intervention of a volunteer. I like to call them an interested stranger because the patients will tell Les and other volunteers all sorts of things that they can't tell anybody else. There is a social side to day hospice, but it's not the majority of what we would say it represents. Now, if they're not able to come into day hospice, well, even if they're not even able to get to their GPs, that's really when the hospice at home team come into action. And we've got a team based here in St Albans and Harpenden, one in Decorum, and as I say, three in Buckinghamshire. And that's a 24-hour service, and they respond to the patient's needs. They plan the care with the patients, but then if the patient becomes unwell, they can ring any time, day or night, and they will get at least advice and then visits from the nurses. So they'll respond in the day, and we have an overnight team who covers the whole of our patch. It's quite big, but they do visit patients at night, which of course is the time when patients and their families feel most vulnerable. I have to say the 24-hour hospice at home service is unique in the country, the way that we have it in our organisation, and we are particularly proud of that and how it works then linking with Grove House. It gives us a real extra string to our bow to make it a kind of interactive service for patients really in this area.
So we're talking obviously about mostly here about adults in the way we're thinking, but you also deal with children, is that right?
We do. We have a children's hospice at home team, and we also have a family support team who look after the children of our adult teams who help support them. But our children's hospice at home team care for around 65 children a year across the whole of our area. Very different service because the children, their diagnoses are totally the opposite to our adults. So very luckily, childhood cancer is very rare. So it's about 80% of our children's service will be non-cancer. And they will be things like metabolic disorders, genetic disorders, certain syndromes that are very rare. And so we care for them, and we make care for them for a number of years, but they go up to the age of 19, and then we are reviewing at the moment how we care for those into other adult services because they do change.
Are we dealing here with a service which is free at the point of use? I mean, if somebody's called out in the middle of the night, the person who arrives, there's no cost to the patient?
No.
And there's no cost in the day hospice as well?
Or? Well, apart from nominal £5 that will provide them with their lunch and their teas and coffees throughout the day.
If there is a particular need for patients that have other elements of nutritional needs, we can get that from the NHS. That's a shared service. We are all trained, all the nurses are trained in guiding them on how to eat, because of course, when you're not well, you don't really want to. So it's just knowing what best to do while you're unwell and whether you should drink more or less or whatever. So we guide them as we go. Again, it's about, as Les said earlier, about their well-being, ensuring that they feel strong enough to enjoy their day and that they've got enough calories on board to manage that.
Who's going to say whether a patient would be better to come in for the day hospice or to stay at home and be visited? Is that a decision that the patient makes, or is that a decision that you will advise them?
It's a bit of both, because over this last year we've set up a referral centre with St Francis Hospice and the Peace Hospice in Hertfordshire, which centralises all referrals. And so often that referral is what we call triaged. It's assessed for where it's best for them to go. Very often a GP would ask for Rennie Grove Hospice at home. But my guide is if a patient's able to go to the hairdressers, they're really able to come to a clinic or come to day hospice. And I think they would benefit from day hospice. In reality, we do visit a lot of people who are still going out and about, but in a limited way. So there's not a defined line of saying you can't have hospice at home or you can't have day hospice or or you must do this. It's assessed on individual need to some degree.
As you said earlier, the developments in medical research and results of that research are going on all the time. And so is the role of a hospice just keep on changing?
It's not that many years ago, probably 10 years ago, when I think it was very obvious that if you went into a hospice, what was going to happen? And I think patients and families have been very worried about that. We've been worried about that as time's gone on, because that's not happening now. Patients will go into a hospice for a period of time, maybe to have their symptoms controlled or to have themselves assessed so that they can come home again. And then when they come home again, they're well. And they may be discharged from everybody. And I think the word hospice is a problem, but whatever we call ourselves will still be related to what we were. So it's getting our viewpoint and the message across that the word hospice doesn't mean that you go in and you die, that any hospice care is there to help you on every level of your illness, not just the symptoms, not just the diagnosis, but the impact of it on you personally, on your family. Because of course, the other thing that we rely on very heavily is family carers. We do spend a lot of time and resource on supporting carers. We have people who volunteer in our carer support group, because carers are now being asked in the home to do a lot of clinical things that not many years ago the resources were there to do for them. But there's been cuts across the whole piece. So there's less nursing availability, there's less social care. So family carers are being asked to do a lot of monitoring, administering medication. In some instances, they're actually administering injections. They're trained by us. But it's a change in role, and they have to feel safe and secure to do that, because if they can't or they don't feel able to, then patients can't really stay at home. The government are driving people to stay at home. They don't want them to be admitted to hospital if it's not necessary. But families do need to feel safe to enable that to happen. So a lot of the care we give, both in day hospice and in the home, is to ensure they feel safe and cared for, and that they can ring us anytime and someone will help them.
Thank you very much, Sue. Thank you, Les.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming in. Now, you can find a whole lot more about this amazing organisation by looking at its website. That's rennygrove.org. There you'll find out about the range of services, as well as ways that you can volunteer or raise funds or simply donate.